Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, reporter Joey Capoletti with AP and Colin Jackson with the Michigan Public Radio Network discuss what stories are brewing while the legislature is on summer recess. How does Michigan become more attractive to young people? And what policy proposals could define the final months of 2023? Donald Roach with the Smart Union for Rail Workers contemplates if Michigan missed the train for high-speed rail, as well as the unclear future for disputed rail safety legislation. Finally, critics say the more than $2.8 billion LEO budget is a plate full of pork. Senator Mary Kavanaugh says it's full of historic investment into Michigan's underserved and overlooked communities. Now, here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. I'm your temporary host, Samantha Schreiber, while Kaya Malin is out of town. We have a very awesome segment for you all today. We'll be hearing from Donald Roach, the legislative liaison for the Smart Union in Michigan, which represents rail and transportation workers, as well as Senator Mary Kavanaugh, the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee Chair, overseeing the LEO budget. But first, I want to begin with a very special segment featuring my fellow Capital journalists and my friends behind the media table. We have Joey Capoletti, the State House reporter for AP, and we also have Colin Jackson, a political reporter for the Michigan Public Radio Network. How are you all doing today?
Doing good. Thanks so much for having us today, Sam.
Yeah, it's been a great morning so far.
No, that's awesome. Okay, so we're kind of in a weird area right now. So the state legislature just approved a massive budget. It's on its way to the governor's desk. But now, kind of following the 4th of July holiday, we're in a bit of a slow news spot. So while we're in this, we like to say summer recess. Lawmakers like to say in-district work time. But what are you all covering right now?
For AP right now, I'm kind of looking back at the past 6 months a little bit. Michigan, obviously, is one of the few states that has a full year session. Some states just have a couple of months. So we still obviously have a lot of time left. One thing, kind of a sneak peek that we're working on right now, is looking at Michigan in comparison to Minnesota, which is the other state that won recently a trifecta, a Democratic trifecta, after 8 years without it. And kind of looking at how the legislation those two states really compares with, Minnesota Democrats also passing a lot of similar legislation. For also covering a lot of, upcoming, I think, House and Senate developments that, over the next couple of weeks. So that's kind of been a little bit of a focus as well.
Yeah, the good news about the legislature being on break is it kind of gives you time to catch up on some of the stories that you may have missed, or some of the bills that you thought were interesting but just didn't have time to cover or grab as much as you wanted to in the past. So some of the things getting caught up on would have been like Democratic Senator Sean McCann's bill to allow alcohol sales in college sports stadiums. So stuff like that. There's always new press releases, and this is kind of the administration's time to shine outside of the governor's office, where those little things that may have flown out of the radar before kind of get a little more time in the spotlight.
No, I think the MADC, I think right as everyone was leaving for 4th of July weekend, they put out a press release like, we have an electrification hub coming for freight trucks in the state of Michigan, and that's something I'll be working on later. One thing that I think is interesting about the new generation of Capitol reporters in Michigan is that a lot of us were not in the chamber during the Snyder era. So when it comes to things like the right to work repeal, when it comes to things like, Senate Democrats and House Democrats now repealing the no stricter than federal ban for environmental regulations, we weren't here when those policies were initially put in place. So what does that kind of say about the culture where we're at, where a lot of these initial reforms were about undoing Snyder era policies?
I think that's an interesting point. So I'm a little bit older than you guys, Sam. I'm in the upper side of the 20s, firmly in the millennial crew in terms of the Capitol Press Corps. But some of the stuff like the right to work repeal, that was, I believe, my freshman year of college. So while I wasn't around, I remember my experience with that was a little bit different, right? I was working downtown at a restaurant. So when all the protests were coming in and out, I was just serving people food and like hearing what they were saying. So it's interesting now being on the inside of the building, covering it instead of just kind of reading about it tangentially. Like, this affects my life and understanding that this affects your life and this is a big policy decision, but versus living in it, you know, and seeing all of these things. And I think one of the biggest things that plays out is we see these bills come up to undo some Snyder-era policies that you need to kind of look back on and say, like, was that a Snyder-era policy or is this just like, are we returning things to how they were before? Is this a new change? Especially with a lot of the labor bills we're seeing come up, I think, after right to work, that's something interesting.
You know, I think the biggest policy that we should be focused on for after summer recess is going to be, will the Democratic-led legislature allow for local municipalities to establish their own wage and benefits requirements through city ordinances, which is something that they were barred from doing through a Snyder-era preemption? And I think, you know, I think a lot of the conversations we're going to be having is a lot about environmental regulation. I think it's going to be about, you know, expanding access to benefits in the workforce. And I don't know. I mean, I can talk about this for hours that we don't have. But what are some policies that are really sticking out to you, Joey?
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, kind of looking back, first of all, I think going into this next, you know, the second half of the year, there's a lot of stuff, first of all, that's going to be on a time limit, obviously. You know, some of the ballot proposals that passed Prop 1, you know, some of those things are going to have to be passed. I think one interesting one, you know, I talked about Michigan's similarity to Minnesota. They obviously passed, you know, medical, paid medical and family, the paid family and medical leave, which I think will be another thing to kind of watch. I think also for a lot of journalists, the transparency bills are always something of, you know, interest. If, you know, Democrats have said for years that they're looking to expand that, make the legislature more transparent, make the executive office more transparent. I think, you know, if they follow through on that promise, as they've been saying they will, is going to be something to really watch in the second half of 2023.
Yeah, and we have a spreadsheet coming our way. Who requested all the special projects in the budget? Which, I mean, the Leo budget had 208 pre-selected grant recipients for multi-million dollar grants. And you would imagine that this would be a competitive program where multiple institutions would find out about and jump toward, but there's a lot of kind of pre-selection going on. And I think we saw that with this latest budget. One big thing to talk about, though, is population growth. I mean, Michigan, as is anticipated, what is it, like 2045 is when we're expected to have more than 40,000 more deaths than births in the state of Michigan. And as reporters, we have to ask the question of, you know, why isn't Michigan sexy right now? And how has that been going for you all?
I think maybe, you know, going back to a couple of questions, some of my background is I'm 24 years old. I'm from the west side of Michigan in Saugatuck. And I actually left Michigan to go to college in Oregon. And I came back last year for the position here at the state capitol. And I think, you know, when we're talking about population growth and, you know, how to change things, oftentimes it's you know, focusing on our age range, you know, 20s, 30s. I think that's often, you know, the age range that's really leaving. And, you know, I look at a lot of my high school friends, a lot of, you know, people I know that went to Michigan State, went to Michigan. And I don't know about you two, a lot of my friends have left for, you know, jobs and, you know, a lot of people, you know, went to Denver, to Chicago, to New York. And, you know, I think really focusing on, you know, what opportunities are there here for young people after college. And I think, you know, this, we were talking obviously a little bit before we started recording, but, you know, with this new population growth panel that the governor is starting, so far, we only know about, you know, there'll be at least one slot for someone under 25 years old. So I think to really have a panel that's going to be effective and really come up with, you know, effective policy is really having, you know, you're really trying to get those 20 and 30 year olds. So you're really going to have them on this panel really being leading the charge, I think, on a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, and the same thing as Joey. So my background, I'm 28. I grew up here around Lansing, moved away, went to college at Michigan State, moved away when I was 24 for Kentucky, and then moved back a couple years ago. And moving back to Michigan wasn't really something I ever had on my to-do list. But when it happened, you know, it was interesting. There's more stuff, I will say, especially around Lansing, than there used to be. But I think, to Joey's point, there's still a lot of just lacking amenities that younger people want in this world, you know. Obviously, like, Detroit is a world-class city, so if there's something to do on the week, if you want to have that kind of all-night nightlife experience, you got to go to Detroit or Grand Rapids. But I think for even as far as getting to those places, though, we don't have the same type of public transportation infrastructure that I think some other bigger states would have. During the consensus revenue estimating conference, one of the things that was mentioned is a lot of states are kind of population control is shifting or consolidating to other states and like flowing into states like Texas or Utah or Idaho, et cetera. And why isn't Michigan among those states attracting talent from kind of these overflowed cities, I think is going to really be a question that comes down to what are we offering that other states and other cities can't offer. And right now, I'm not seeing a ton that Michigan is doing spectacularly well in terms of making it worth living in.
I just, in going off of Colin's point right there too, one thing that I've, you know, as I mentioned, I'm from Saugatuck, which is a tourist town on the beach, and I go back there often, and one thing I often hear about is things like, you know, how difficult it is in Michigan to get a liquor license. And there's just certain barriers like that. Like, I just read an article in Grand Rapids where people have been waiting for over a year to get a liquor license, and these businesses are losing, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars. And I spoke with someone who was trying to open a business in Grand Rapids, and the line was, it was way too much money basically to get a liquor license. So they just decided to go to Oak Park in Illinois and start a restaurant there instead. And I think, you know, things like that, that's a small, you know, policy thing. But it is when you're like Michigan competing with, you know, other places like Wisconsin that have great coastlines, you know, you're competing with just states around. Those small things where people are leaving and taking their business elsewhere, I think really add up. And I think it's really trying to, as Colin said, you know, what are you doing differently? What are you, how are you attracting businesses? And once you do that, you know, once you attract businesses, that's how, you know, more people end up coming to the state.
And one last point, and sorry to just join in.
No, please do.
I was just going to say, this isn't a new problem, right? We've heard about public transportation. We've heard about young people leaving Michigan for forever. The state didn't turn geriatric overnight. This has been a decades-long problem in the making. And I think that we still haven't seen it. And I don't think this is a matter of lack of trying. I just think that the solutions being brought forward or the actualization of whatever solutions have been brought forward haven't worked to date.
You know, I think one thing that's coming to my mind of what is going to be a task that Democrats are going to take up in Lansing, and I think it's going to be, how do you make necessities more accessible? Because I think access to necessities is also part of the population conversation. I think it's, you know, you have Senate Majority Leader Brainz. I mean, she, while serving in the minority, she advocated for ways to make prescription drugs more accessible and less expensive. Are we going to see a big revolutionary package on that? Also housing. I think housing has already been a huge theme. I think we're going to continue to see that. I know even for me, trying to find a place in Lansing to reside has been a barrier. So I'm a little bit curious to see what more comes with that, especially when we zoom in on the missing middle of the housing conversation.
Right, because it seems like, for example, I live near downtown in an apartment complex, and they raised my rent $120 when I re-signed my lease. And there wasn't for any new amenities offered. There wasn't really a lot of upkeep or maintenance done on the property, et cetera. So you're paying so much to live in a place where you feel like I could be paying the same amount to live in a much bigger city with much more amenities, where the bars, for example, don't close and kick everyone out at 1 o'clock at night on a Friday. You know, so I think, yeah, between housing and just amenities, I think those are two of the biggest things that the state's going to have to address.
But then I also want to dive in, because I know I want to talk about, you know, things to also expect when it comes to politics, not just policy. I think you're seeing the relationship between Democrats and the business community become more frigid. You saw the business community stray away from Republicans as there was this boost in the MAGA conversation that they really didn't have the same appetite for. But when we talk about, you know, what I just talked about, giving municipalities the ability to establish their own minimum wage requirements higher than the statewide standard, when we talk about no stricter than federal environmental regulations and possibly stricter environmental regulations, I wonder if that's going, you know, if jobs is a part of the population growth conversation, are Democrats going to have an obstacle as the business community begins to stray away and possibly return to their Republican roots in this upcoming state House election?
I mean, I think it's something that I'm curious to see as well. Just the Democratic majority in the legislature, their relationship with the business community has been interesting. You know, there's been this willingness to provide businesses with large amounts of incentives. At the same time, there has been this kind of re-regulation of like restoring or the repeal of right to work, for example, and some of these changing labor laws and the planned repeal for no stricter than federal, stuff like that. So I think that at the end of the day, the business community, one thing they look for is stability in laws and policies. So I think regardless of if it's whatever the status quo is at the end of this Democratic administration or leadership, I think stability is something that they're looking for more than kind of this yo-yo back and forth from one to another, one to another, one to another, depending on who's in control.
Yeah, and I think so, too. I mean, I think it's just a kind of a, you know, changing of the guard a little bit, too. You obviously have, you know, I think everyone, you know, is developing new relationships with the new leadership. You know, it's for years there's kind of been a certain, you know, leadership, and I think everyone's adapting now to changing, you know, policies and changing leadership. And you know, who knows? You know, obviously Democrats have the trifecta right now, which gives them full control, and who knows how long that's going to last. But I think everyone's kind of, you know, you're just seeing a real changing of the guard. And as you had mentioned, you know, I wasn't here as much during the Snyder years and things like that, but I think just it's interesting just seeing everyone adapt, I guess, a little bit.
One last question about population growth. You know, I mean, look at the SOAR fund, which is the corporate incentive fund, which is going toward mega sites, battery plants. You know, those are kind of some of the most highlighted, spotlighted headlines right now. Is a mega site sexy for a young person? You know, I think a young person might like the idea of having an EV, but like, do young people actually want to be working at those battery plants?
Well, I think that's kind of part of the question is when you see these numbers and it's saying, you know, this site is going to create, you know, this many thousands of jobs, but then you know, look at what is the actual wage, you know, and salary of those jobs, and is that actually going to attract people? And, you know, you look Ford, for instance, you know, they have announced, you know, opening these massive battery plants, things like that. But then there's also these announcements that they're laying off, you know, mass amount of blue collar workers and things like that. And so I definitely think that's tied into population growth. Is obviously any job is important, you know, if it's 50K, 60K, but what is the quality of those jobs? Who are you attracting to those jobs? And if at the same time you're laying off, you know, these other positions, then you know, I do think there's some questions about that.
Right. And a lot of these mega site jobs have kind of been billed as, oh, keeping people in these more rural communities like Big Rapids or in Marshall, giving young people an opportunity to stay there with a good paying job. But then, as Joey mentioned, you kind of have to question, what is the actual function? Like, how does this play out in practice? How good are these jobs in the first place? And two, do young people want to stay in these smaller communities if they have a choice? And I haven't seen the data one way or another, so that's not me saying I know the answer because I don't. But I think that's another interesting part of it. Another question that needs to be asked, though, like, okay, so you build it, will they come?
No, definitely. And obviously, we just got, well, this will come out on Monday, obviously, but, you know, we're following the 4th of July weekend. People were talking about politics at the family barbecue. What are some political chaotic events that you are kind of preparing for or you're theorizing for the rest of 2023?
I'm glad you asked that. So I want to see where kind of the cracks break down amongst Democrats and the legislative leadership, because I think what we saw for the first 6 months was this push to get all these priorities. You know, they outlined, I think, the first six priorities, and they did them right at one another in rapid succession. And now we're kind of seeing some of the leftover stuff like, oh, this would be nice to have. Like Democrats saying, oh, that, I want that, I want that, I want that. And not all these things have moved with that same speed that other priorities have that everyone's unified on. So, for example, I'm curious to see what's happening with these drive safe bills, which would allow people to receive state IDs regardless of legal documentation status. I think that's something that has been around in policy talks for a long time, but I don't necessarily know if there's enough support to get that across the finish line, at least quickly as a priority. other things, like we saw, like House Labor Committee held a hearing a few months back on these wage theft bills. And there was just that one hearing so far. And I think there's a lot of kind of work that needs to be done to get those to the finish line, if ever. And also some of the criminal justice reform stuff, where we're even seeing like Attorney General Dana Nessel step in and kind of express a little bit of doubts, you know, with some of these proposals as well.
Yeah, I think Colin, you know, mentioned kind of the main thing, which I'm also looking at is, you know, these first couple of months, a lot of this stuff is, I think, you know, Senator Brink said is, you know, 40 years of pent up policy. It was kind of, you know, at the beginning of the year outlining these are the things that we want to pass. We have, you know, support of most of the members and we can pass them. But, you know, is that same party discipline going to stick when they're attacking, you know, these larger, more maybe controversial issues? One of the things I'm looking at is, you know, gun measures. Is they passed these bills that had, you know, popularity and polling, you know, in the general public and also in as far as members. But, you know, going further as far as, you know, banning assault weapons or, you know, high-capacity magazines, things like that that maybe will be more difficult to pass. I'm very interested in looking at, you know, what party discipline will look at or look like in that. And, you know, if they're going to try to push the envelope a little bit further with some of these more controversial, I guess, bills.
You know, like, I do want to ask one more question. I know we're going a little over time, but Colin, I know, you know, we've had conversations about Black representation, people of color representation, the press corps. You know, today we just had Senator Sarah Anthony announce that she would not be running for that open congressional seat. How do you think Democrats are doing when it comes to recruiting people of color to some of these open and very highly competitive federal seats that we're going to see opened up in 2024?
2024 is going to be an interesting year, obviously, with the biggest one being Debbie Stabenow's U.S. Senate seat. We've already seen a few Black candidates and candidates of color declare for that race. Obviously, right now, what a lot of the conversations have focused around Representative Alyssa Slotkin, who is a white woman. But then we've also seen, for example, State Board of Education member Pamela Pugh. We've had a few other people enter the race. I'm not quite sure where the party is currently standing or how it's currently doing in terms of getting minority representation into the state legislature, at least. You know, we only see 3 Black lawmakers in the Senate, and this was something that was brought up even way back during redistricting. Obviously, Democrats benefited from those district maps because they took the majority, but at what cost? You know, when it comes to Black representation, I'm not sure the exact number of Black lawmakers in the House and how it compares to last session as well. But I do think that for some of these high profile seats, there could have been an expectation where the party could have set up maybe a more diverse candidate pool for example, like you mentioned, the congressional seat to fill what Alyssa Slotkin's congressional seat. And I think that it'll be interesting to see if the party takes more steps or if it kind of continues with the status quo.
Any additional comments before we close out on 2023? We're halfway done. I don't like to think about that. It makes me anxious, but we are.
Yeah, I mean, wow, what a first 6 months. You know, I think it'll be an interesting next 6 months, and hopefully we'll get to recap this, you know, maybe in December or something like that.
Yeah, thank you for contributing to my caffeine dependency, everybody. Thank you guys so much for being on and joining me today.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. It was fun. It's going to my...
We are now here with Donald Roach. He's the legislative liaison for SMART in Michigan, which stands for, okay, Don, I'm going to try this. The Sheet Metal Air, Rail, and Transportation Workers.
That's correct.
Okay, awesome. So thank you so much for being on. And Don, this is your first ever time on the MERS Monday podcast, right?
Yes, it is. And I appreciate you having me. Thank you.
And how long have you been working in Lansing?
Since just right around the COVID time. So I took over in this role in early 2020.
So I want to talk about something that has become a bit of a hot topic in the transportation realm, especially as Michigan has this conversation about ways to attract more population. It's high-speed rail. Did Michigan quite literally miss the train when it comes to high-speed rail?
I like the way you put that. Yeah, I believe to some extent. I don't think totally, but, you know, they left a lot of potential money on the table with the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. there's a lot of availability for high-speed rail funding for passenger rail service for all the states. And I just don't want to see Michigan miss some of that opportunity. I mean, you can look as far as Minnesota. Their legislature just incorporated about $195 million to fund the Northern Lights Express portion from Minneapolis to Duluth. And, you know, it was a long time coming for Minnesota as well. So I just, you know, there's a lot of money out there. And like I said, I'd hate to see the state miss some of that funding opportunity.
You know, I know that we just got done with this budget making season with the legislature approving a pretty large, with the omnibus being more than $81 billion. And there was initially a conversation after the Senate Appropriations Transportation Subcommittee recommended $100 million for high-speed rail to get the conversation started. That ended up being reduced to $20 million inside of the LEO budget. Is $20 million actually enough to get the conversation rolling?
Well, that's a good question. I guess the future will be able to tell us the answer to that. But in my opinion, you know, it's we've been underinvested in passenger rail for quite some time. And I know the state of Michigan, along with the Federal Railroad Administration, they have long range plans. And I believe that, you know, it's going to take a lot more money and a lot more investment than $20 million to get the conversation started.
No, and I know that in your capacity, you have a lot of conversations with Michigan's Amtrak operations. What are kind of some things that you're hearing on that side of this discussion of how Amtrak is operating in the state of Michigan?
Well, I think that they would like to see some expansion, but first, they've got some projects that have been in the work for quite some time that the state of Michigan's actually had some funding for. They'd like to increase the speed between Chicago and Pontiac across the Wolverine line to 110 miles an hour across the whole segment. Obviously, they're probably not going to be able to do the 110 miles an hour across the whole line, but and especially the rural areas and stuff like that. They're actually just west of Battle Creek. They actually have now the authority to run 110 miles an hour in certain spots. So that's their goal, is to increase that time frame between Chicago and Pontiac to make it more desirable for travelers. And also to increase frequencies to, you know, compete with the airlines for that short distance to Chicago. And we'd like to see that. Definitely, we'd like to see the increase in frequencies. But along with that comes other problems. You know, we have equipment shortages that they've had here recently. I don't know where the end is with that. The state of Michigan, along with several other Midwestern states, purchased about 88 Siemens Venture cars. Not all of them are in service right now. There's a few that have been out of service due to mechanical issues and stuff like that. So we're waiting to see those cars get online. Hopefully that'll help improve the amount of frequencies and services the state of Michigan sees.
Now, I know that there's a discussion going on right now that I don't have a lot of familiarity on about eliminating, when a train goes from Pontiac to Chicago, eliminating the crew shift in Battle Creek, correct? Yes. What exactly does that mean? Could you explain the situation a bit more for me?
Yeah, so right now the state of Michigan has three Amtrak Wolverine routes that leave Pontiac and go towards Chicago. Or vice versa, Chicago to Pontiac. One, the Blue Water that goes from Port Huron to Chicago and back, and the Pier Marquette out of Grand Rapids to Chicago and back. Currently, the Blue Water and the Wolverine have crew change points where the Amtrak crew base will change in Battle Creek. So you'll have a crew take it from Pontiac to Battle Creek or Port Huron to Battle Creek. They'll change crews, and the other crew will take it.
And what is the point of that?
The point is, it's no, one of them can be safety. You know, it's very demanding service, traveling at extremely high speeds. So it takes a lot of focus and a lot of demand for the engineer. Some contractual limitations for, I believe it's a 6-hour limitation for an engineer to be solo alone on an Amtrak train on the head end. If anything over 6 hours, they require an assistant engineer. So Amtrak thinks that they'll be able to save the state of Michigan some money by eliminating that crew change point. We have different thoughts on that, of course. Battle Creek historically has always been a crew change point. A lot of employees have been based out of that location. Recently, Amtrak has been pretty vocal about their plans in the future to eliminate that crew base altogether when they can increase the speed and not have to perform that crew change point in Battle Creek. The impact that I think that we'll see with that could be an economic one. These are good high-paying jobs. Amtrak through our discussions and stuff, it seems like that they want to run their services kind of like an airport hub, like Detroit's a hub for Delta, Chicago's a hub for United or whatever, and just operate all their operations out of Chicago with Chicago-based crews. So not only will we lose membership, we're also going to lose that economic impact of these very well-paying jobs in the region that support those services. Not only that, incidents happen, mechanical failures, trespasser strikes, things of that nature that unfortunately still occur. And when things like that happen, there's long delays, and that's where we get frustrated passengers. And it only takes one frustrated passenger to say, I'm never riding Amtrak again, after a long, say like October of 2022, the historical 19-hour train ride that that some of the passengers had to endure. We don't want to see that. Battle Creek is like the halfway point. Railroad crews are historically given a 2-hour call to report to duty. So if you have an incident like that, you're going to have a crew come from Pontiac or Chicago. That's going to be 2 hours for their crew to get to their location. And then if the incident happens somewhere in the middle of nowhere, you're 4 or 5 hours looking at getting a crew there to start the operations to move the passengers from their or to their destination.
Now, I know that we had a conversation earlier this year about kind of should there be more kind of what would be the appropriate term, like kind of some more public safety measures when it comes to Amtrak operations in Michigan, because was it 2020 where there was actually a conductor out of Battle Creek that got punched in the face, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Very unfortunate incident. Employee was just going off duty at a crew change location there, and a gentleman was irate that the train actually left on time, and she told the gentleman that the train wasn't coming back. He missed the train, and essentially he got very upset. There were two women there at Battle Creek. One was an older woman, was a caretaker that he was arguing with, and when the conductor kind of stood up for the gentleman got irate and actually physically assaulted her. So after that, it really drove home some need for some more police presence. A lot of the police presence on Amtrak is more focused on the Northeast Corridor. Michigan actually only had one uniformed Amtrak officer in the state of Michigan based out of Niles, I believe it was. But we had talked with the DC police in Amtrak with in DC there. And we've been told that they're hiring 4 to 5 Amtrak police officers, and they're going to be stationed in Battle Creek. So there's actually more of a police presence. My membership has reached back out to me, and they've noticed that there has been an increased police presence, which is great, because not only do the members or the conductors and engineers need that, the passengers need that as well. So we're really looking forward to keeping, those police officers here to protect our Michigan residents and our membership.
No, so I want to start talking about legislation now, because we're obviously at the halfway point of 2023, if you can believe it or not. So, some bills that did get left behind as of right now, though, as we enter summer recess, it is the 2-person crews for train operations in Michigan, and also the cap on how long trains can be, the freight trains can be in our state. Do you, and I know that this is legislation that your membership has been advocating for in terms of safety. Where exactly are we right now with the conversation?
Well, first I'd like to say rail safety, it's a growing concern, not just here in Michigan, across the United States. As everyone probably has heard, back in February, the big derailment in East Palestine, Ohio. That's just one thing that the public knows about right now. We as an organization and our membership see this stuff firsthand, boots on the ground. We deal with it every day. So it really is a increasing concern. Just here since my tenure, since 2020 in my position, I feel that probably I'm going to say close to 6 unsafe working condition issues where I've had to get the Michigan Department of Transportation involved with their rail safety division to come in and help correct some of these unsafe working conditions. 2 MyOSHA cases, one during COVID, one for other unsafe working conditions, and numerous Federal Railroad Administration alleged violations that I've had to file on behalf of the membership just due to the unsafe nature of the railroad. Did you know that the railroads historically A railroad employee could not get insurance because the work was so dangerous. And we actually had to form our own fraternal insurance association back in the early 1900s to help with people actually being covered by workplace injuries and stuff like that. So
I had no idea.
Yes. Yeah. The term railroad, it came from somewhere.
Especially what was the cap, the proposed in that legislation? What is the proposed cap on how long freight trains can be in our state?
The proposed cap was 7,500 feet. A lot of people think that that's an arbitrary number. I don't believe that it's arbitrary at all. If you look at historically the infrastructure that the railroads were built on, trains meet and pass in what we call sidings. So it's a shorter track next to the main track where a train can essentially pull over and let another train meet or pass. Most sidings in the state of Michigan, the average size through my calculations, through going through some of the class one railroads, are anywhere from 5,000 to 8,000 feet on average. There are some that are longer and there's some that are shorter, but on average, you know, so we're right around the 7,500 feet mark.
You know, what is the longest train that you've ever heard of coming through Michigan?
Through Michigan, somewhere in the 14, I'd have to ask to verify, but it was over 14,000 feet long.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Well, how long does that take to wait for a train that size?
You're going to make me do math.
No. I'm like, oh my goodness. That I feel like if I knew that a 14,000 foot long train was coming through, I would definitely have a little bit of road anxiety, if that's okay to share.
Yes, it does take a very long time. And it just depends on how fast the train's actually moving, obviously. But not only does it take longer, you know, they take longer to start and stop. So a lot of the opposition has stated that, well, you're just going to have more trains, so you're going to have more black crossings. That may be true to some degree, but the trains are going to be shorter and the wait time is not going to be as long. The biggest problem with this is the blocking of the emergency personnel. Could you imagine if your house was on fire or a friend or family member was in need of emergency care and they couldn't get there because of a train blocking a crossing, and it takes exponentially that much longer to get around the train to go a different route. And it's happened before. It's not hyperbole. It's happened.
You know, I mean, we have a legislature this year that has, you know, kind of proven itself to be very ambitious when it comes to moving out policy in a very fast rate. Why do you think that same amount of fast moving energy that we've noticed with the Democratic majority has not taken place with these bills?
Well, I think going back to the two-person crew bill that you originally asked about, Senate Bill 100, there is some preemption issues that the courts have raised. We believe as an organization that the courts missed the mark on a lot of their rulings, especially the most recent one from the state of Illinois. They always reference the Conrail 3R Act. The Conrail 3R Act was put in place back in the 1970s when they had a lot of customer service issues in the whole Northeast region. You know, the 2008 Rail Safety Improvement Act that Congress enacted back in 2008 had a section in there where they asked the Secretary of Transportation to go back and do a study of whether or not that certain section in the Conrail 3R Act needed to be repealed. They performed their study and they released their results in 2011. And they stated that the primacy of federal law over state law in this area existed in order to serve a narrow and specifically defined purpose, the privatization of Conrail. The purpose has been met and it is appropriate to return the primacy of state law. So what they're saying there is that, you know, back in the 70s, this was an issue, but now all those customer service issues that they had in the Northeast back in the 70s, you know, Conrail doesn't even exist anymore. CSX and Norfolk Southern actually purchased them together back in 1999. So Conrail doesn't exist anymore. We believe that it wouldn't stand withstand constitutional scrutiny any further because the purpose of that law has been met. Why it hasn't been repealed from Congress is beyond me. But there's a study out there that was required and it was done. It was completed. And they stated that, you know, the law should be repealed.
When it comes to dealing with a federally regulated industry, though, I mean, could Michigan, if this legislation were to pass, could it be challenged in a higher court for interfering with commerce within our country?
Potentially. They did that just recently here in Ohio. I don't know if you saw the most recent, but the Association of American Railroads just sued the state of Ohio for passing their two-person crew law just here recently within the last month or two. So we'll see how that works out through the courts. You know, I'm hoping that it makes it a little bit further than just a circuit court for a better decision on the behalf of the safety of Michigan members, Ohio members, you know, members across, or I'm sorry, people across the state of the United States. That's what we're looking for. We just want the public to be safe. You know, the railroad operations are getting more and more dangerous, it seems. So that's our main focus and main goal is to focus on employee and public safety.
So I know you have those two bills, but is there anything else that you plan to be advocating for as we go into the final 6 months of 2023?
I think the strong push is still going to be for rail safety. We have, I've had numerous conversations, you know, for different things. One of the big things is, like I stated before, I've had six, issues where I've had to get the state of Michigan involved, for making the railroad correct these unsafe conditions. It shouldn't take the state to get involved in this, but fortunately for us under the Railway Code of 1993, we have an avenue to do that. It's not the greatest. I'd like to see, I've proposed some changes to that. To make sure that the railroads can't stand in the way of getting these unsafe conditions corrected in a timely fashion.
Is there anything else that you would like to add for today's segment of MERS News, MERS Monday podcast?
Yeah, just the, you know, with the Amtrak stuff, I think that the state of Michigan should really reach out to, you know, like say Indiana, they have the NICTI Railroad, which is a Northern Indiana commuter railroad there. They've proposed an extension to their South Shore line called the West Lake Extension, and it reaches down into different communities. I think, you know, with the proposed Amtrak, or not Amtrak, but the proposed Ann Arbor to Traverse City, you know, different routes, maybe connecting Grand Rapids and Detroit. Those things should be really looked at to allow for, you know, increased economic, social, and environmental benefits.
Do you think, as you know, we continue on this theme of population growth in Michigan, do you think that passenger rail makes a state more attractive?
I think so. When you go to Chicago, you can just get about anywhere with just jumping on a train. You really don't need a car. I think the big focus in Michigan, you know, with the big three, you know, everybody has a vehicle, which is, I'm not saying it's wrong or right. I have a vehicle, but I don't have any other options of travel, you know, like they do in other larger cities. I'd like to see that. Yeah, I'd love to see an increase. I think it would be more attractive.
Do you think that this recent budget is lacking because they did the 20 million instead of the 100 million?
I think we could have included a little bit more. I think just it costs a lot of money to do these studies to see what the economic impact is. And that economic impact is long term. That lasts for a long time. That increases the tax base, too. So we'd love to see some more investment in passenger rail here in the state of Michigan, not just for our membership, but, you know, for everybody as a whole.
Well, thank you so much, Don Roach, with the Legislative Liaison for SMART, the Sheet Metal Air, Rail, and Transportation Union, representing rail and transportation workers. Did I get that right, Don?
Yes.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for joining me here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Scott. So sick and tired of the pouring rain, I took the train to Morocco just to kill the pain. Oh, it might help a little.
First final segment of today's episode, today's edition of the MERS Monday podcast, we have State Senator Mary Kavanaugh, the chair of the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee overseeing the LEO and the MEDC budget, and a Redford Township Democrat. So let's just dive in to this LEO budget because it was pretty massive, $2.86 billion for the fiscal year 2024. And already in this budget, you had more than $760 million worth in grants that have already been dedicated to 208 pre-selected projects throughout Michigan. There was obviously some publications and some critics that saw the LEO budget and specifically said, oh my goodness, there's so much pork in here, I can build a BLT sandwich. Senator Kavanaugh, what is your response to the criticism, you know, that this budget seems a bit porky?
Well, good morning, Sam. I'm actually really glad you asked this question because I would actually call these investments maybe that bread in that sandwich, because the investments we see in this budget are priorities that we have established from one, both sides of the aisle. But what I believe most importantly are really in areas that have been overlooked or underfunded for generations. We really took intentional approaches of prioritizing people in this budget, and I do believe people are the backbone and key to our communities. And a lot of these people and communities have been undervalued and overlooked in previous budgets. And so I was just really excited. And as we hear a lot about making it in Michigan and all of that talk, this is really putting our money where our mouth is, from transforming our communities to vibrant, walkable destinations, growing our talent, youth, there's adult literacy in there, expansion to Michigan Reconnect, all the way to attracting businesses and families and putting our people first in this great state. And as we've seen in the first 6 months with inclusive policy, now we're seeing it in equitable investments across the state.
I know with this budget that you initially had, so targets were established, and those spending targets were then given to the subcommittee chairs, both you and then it would be State Rep Snyder over in the House, correct, with his subcommittee, and then also the LEO director. Could you tell us a little bit about what that negotiation table looked like for you three once these spending targets were established?
Yeah, so I was a bit nervous, just because it was my first time going into the room, but it was something that I really truly enjoyed. What we brought to the table as far as my counterpart, Representative Snyder, and even the governor's office and the department, I didn't have to concede anything, if you can believe it, because everyone in the room, the grants, the projects, and the priorities was something we all valued. And with so many like-minded individuals in that room, it was fairly easy to work on the same page and move in the same direction when crafting this budget and really deciding what we want to prioritize and push through.
I mean, is there anything in the Senate, though, that you did lose that you were pretty upset or maybe just had a down moment about?
I don't think so. I think that the differences in the budget was very slim. I know they might have looked different on face value, but I created large buckets that invested in affordable housing, local infrastructure, minority businesses, even startups and senior centers or community improvements. And I really think that that's exactly what we brought out of this budget in the final walkthrough. And the things that we were fighting for from the governor's office and my House counterpart, Representative Snyder, like I said, it was a lot of things that we all valued. Adult literacy was, it just didn't even seem like a fight. It seemed like a conversation of these projects and these ideas are something we really need to build up in our budget and really give the supports needed for our communities. And there wasn't really any disagreement from the parties. It was actually one time I was fighting for the inclusivity of some Latino or Latinx or even immigrant population, as we saw in the new Michigander Fund. And it was more of like me asking and them saying, that sounds great. And so I think it was fairly easy to work in that room and crafting a historic budget for the people of Michigan.
But you know, why pre-selected grant recipients? Why not let even unknown organizations compete for a non-determined grant program?
So I think that's actually a great question, Sam, because this won't be the first time that we see this so-called investments in previous budgets. And I think the difference is, and why we were so intentional about it, is because we really wanted to see investments that, like I mentioned, that hasn't been seen before to certain communities, to people that have been overlooked and over underfunded. And so when it comes to housing, when it comes to minority-owned business support and jail diversion and startups, I think my point here, Sam, is that this is the first time in the budget we are seeing funding in areas that are really going to set up our community for success. and funding that not doesn't strain the budget for future years, but make sure that there's intentional investments and a little bit of room for other people to have a bite at the apple. And I do think that this budget are issues we've been trying to address for years, generations even, from this ongoing housing crisis, strengthening our workforce, crumbling infrastructure, and even an intention in equity and transparency. I think that's why we're so intentional on where we're kind of allocating these funds and what this budget's going to look like by the end of it.
One thing that I also want to ask about is that, you know, you have things like the $30 million for the Detroit Police Department to start purchasing freeway cameras. There is, I have it in front of me, have $40 million for the Macomb County Jail. You have $10 million for the Dearborn Heights Fire Station. Why did these specifically go into the LEO budget as opposed to, you know, the Michigan State Police budget or the transportation budget? Why did all of these miscellaneous projects end up here?
Well, actually, when I first became chair of the LEO subcommittee, I was forewarned that some things would fall into the LEO budget. And it kind of is an inclusivity of all things from transportation to public safety. And I do think that these fell specifically in there just because we're able to be a little bit more flexible with our funding. We wanted to make sure that in those specific budgets, we were funding the areas that we needed to. And in the LEO budget, it was a little bit more about including areas in what we saw in investments that are a little bit more equitable. Like you said, from Detroit to Grand Rapids to high investments in Lansing and Flint, it's high minority communities within the state. And so I do think that this is also where we could fit it in the budget, where we can also put that transparency lens on anything that goes through and making sure that it is something that is align with our values, align with what we kind of want to see in our state, and also give people a little bit of a support system that are doing some great things in our communities and make sure we uplift them.
You know, I want to talk about one of my favorite things to talk about. I'm sure you know this more than anyone in Lansing, Senator Kavanaugh, the SOAR Fund. So I just want to clarify here, though, that just because you didn't see that consecutive year-to-year funding stream for the SOAR Fund in this budget language, it doesn't mean that that doesn't already exist, correct? Because that was already established in a supplemental that was approved earlier this year.
Yep.
Yeah. And so how does that work? It's like, because I know it's if our state has the excess corporate income tax revenue, then how much does the SOAR fund get for, I believe, the next 3 years?
I believe it's $500 million, but I'd have to double check with that.
No, definitely. Now, so were you able to establish any SOAR fund related boilerplate language in this bill, in this latest budget bill?
The latest budget bill, no, just because it was because it already passed earlier this year. As you saw in the budget that I released from the Senate, there is a couple boilerplate languages that includes community investments or community buy-in, a little bit of an environmental piece. But because it was already passed in the beginning of the year, there is a little bit that tied our hand with what was already in statute and after already appropriated money to attach anything specifically to that. But I was very excited because as I added that in boilerplate, I was with the full understanding that we were unable to actually change it. But I wanted to just flag not only to people reading it, but also something that myself and Chair of Community and Economic Development, Senator Mallory McMorrow, is really working on, is something that we really want to attach to this funding. And as we saw in some appropriation committee on next gen or next level on companies coming in to make sure that our workers are top priority, that making sure our communities want them in that location and making sure that they're giving back because we're just not something that can be used. And so I think that boilerplate language is something that kind of gives a little bit of a flag of what you will be seeing coming down the pipe as we move forward and making sure that we are talking not only to our Senate colleagues, but our House colleagues on this is not going to be a SOAR fund that has ever been seen before, and making sure that we do have that tool to compete as a state, but we are also making sure that we are holding true to our values, holding true that workers deserve a livable wage, our communities are being built up, that anybody that comes in is responsible for any spill or any environmental repercussions, and really holding our hands to the fire on not only having that tool, but making sure we're using it right.
You know, I think one thing that's interesting about your legislative journey, Senator Kavanaugh, is that I believe you didn't initially support the SOAR fund. And then here you are in both the Appropriations Committee and chairing this LEO subcommittee, where the SOAR fund is this constant conversation, either up front or in the background.
That is interesting. And I think that's a really good note to make, and a really good hat off to Senate Majority Leader Winnie Brinks. And I do think that I was not shy about me not supporting the SOAR as it is, and then coming into the Senate and understanding that we needed to kind of close deals that have already been made previous to this legislature, and understanding that, okay, if we're going to do that, we are going to see it move in a direction that we're all comfortable with. We have a new majority. And people that are, like what I said with the LEO budget, we have certain values that people is the number one and the backbone to our communities. And we can't talk out of the side of our mouth when we do the SOAR. And I think every single colleague in the House and the Senate, well, at least just speak for the Senate, but they all understand that this is a great tool, but we need to see it in those areas change a little bit to make us feel a little bit more comfortable with inviting these companies, that we're not being used as a state for some of these credits or some of these availability and wins that they can have, and then kind of turn their back. I know Senator Mallory McMorrow sometimes mentions the Amazon or A2 facility and how they partner with colleges and universities and really give back to the community. And so that's kind of the North Star that we are heading towards. And so I think it says a lot on my placement in some of these committees. And it says a lot about how I am, even as a young person, I'm consistently involved in these conversations as we talk about growing Michigan's population and being here in 50 years for future generations. And I think I bring that to the table every single time I think about legislation or even the SOAR investments of what are the next 50 years going to look like? How is this going to benefit our community and our state?
And you oversaw a more than $2.86 billion budget here. Do you think that you'll be able to do that again next year? And I mean, there's a constant conversation going on right now that all of this money that we saw spent, the surplus we saw dedicated to things, is going to go away really, really fast.
Yeah. And I think that's a good thing to have in the back of your head, because I think that's a great question, especially, like you said, being chair of LEO, but I'm also on several other appropriation committees and I'm chair of finance. So I think this is just something we should always be aware of as we spend money and prepare for future budgets. So I think it was very crucial that we were very strategic on how we spent not only the general fund and school aid dollars, but the increased federal funds we have by investing in paying off MIPSR's debt, including funding for the budget stabilization fund, even debt service for the Department of Transportation. But even those one-time investments we were talking about were chosen with the idea that this would not burden future budgets or tie our hands if we were to see any decrease in funding over the next few years. So along with general fund, we really utilized the federal funding available without setting ourselves up for an unsustainable future. And like I said, even as chair, we're going through some of these tax credits and initiatives, making sure that we aren't going to have to cut in a few years. I mean, I still want to be around, and this isn't a House seat. I'm going to be around for the next 4 years, at least guaranteed, where every time I'm going to be working with the budget, I'm going to be working in a finance committee where I can kind of decide where the arrow goes on how much money we're spending and what direction we're moving. And I think I can talk for all of my colleagues. We do not want to be burdened with having to make cuts in areas that we really are truly investing in now. And so it was really crucial, these big influx influx of funds and everything of the one-time investments were really chosen with the idea that this isn't going to be an ongoing thing.
You know, I know something that the Republican minority has been advocating for when it comes to economic development is a research and development R&D tax credit. Do you think that when it comes to building future budgets, you might have to step away from direct grant awards and more toward this type of tax credit or more tax breaks?
I think there's going to be several avenues of what we can take to be a little bit more creative, to not have to make cuts to areas that we saw in history. I mean, we took money from our seniors, we took money from our families, and even from our economic development. And I do think that there's going to be hard decisions in the future. But I do think that's why we, in the first time in 40 years with the Democratic majority, we really wanted to make sure that we're doing strategic investments. And I do think that that might be one idea and one avenue, but I don't think it's the only. And I think there's going to be other ways where we can be a little bit more creative of allowing communities to utilize their resources, of making sure that we're all coming together and being creative with what's coming down from the federal government and making sure that we are investing in areas that aren't going to be clawed back in later years.
Would you go on the record and say that you personally prefer grants over tax breaks?
I would be comfortable going on the record saying that I do prefer grants over tax breaks.
Okay. Okay. And, you know, I do just kind of want to dive into this though, too, because one thing that I did stick out with this Leo budget is the investment into kind of more artistic and creative groups, such as the $3 million Symphony Orchestra grant program. There's some money for the Grand Rapids Ballet, repairing some museums in our state. Could you talk a little bit about why you wanted there to be a creative component in this budget?
Absolutely. So as I grew up even, it was a way to express yourself. And as I worked in different areas, I worked in Detroit Public Schools, I really saw the limitations that funding provided for students, adults, even living in that community, not having that availability of seeing art, hearing symphonies, having the opportunity to play an instrument or even paint. And I think it really created a setback to communities and people that wasn't able to experience that. As we talk about people having to go to college or get a skilled trade, I do think that this needs to be another avenue in Michigan, is that you can grow, you can play, but you can also be creative. And as we see in some of our thriving communities like Royal Oak or Ann Arbor, Ferndale, and there's probably several other areas, but definitely a little bit closer to me, but there's areas that we have arts, we have comedy shows, we have certain things that bring people out and makes the community very unique. Even as you drive through Detroit and Farmers Market, you see murals on the wall. And I think it's just something that we need to hold on to, that creates history, that creates speech, that creates a way of an outlet for people to not only handle their mental health, their behavioral health, but I do think that it is an interesting part of life. And even coming from an anthropology background, I do think it's a way that we grow and we learn and we live. And I don't want anybody to have that opportunity in Michigan and other communities not. So I think it's going to be vital in how we grow and set Michigan up to be a place that people want to not only go to, just to visit some new orchestra or opera, but also a place to stay, to make sure that their children have that opportunity, but also the parents have that creativity side.
No, definitely. Now, if you don't mind me asking, I know that you're one of the younger legislators in the Senate chamber, but how old are you specifically?
I don't mind you asking. I just turned 32 the Saturday before last.
Oh my gosh. Happy late birthday.
Thank you.
You know, in population growth and how to make Michigan more attractive to young people is a huge conversation right now. You know, when you talk to your other friends who are in their young 30s, late 20s, Where do you think Michigan lacks the most when it comes to, you know, being sexy for new young people to come here?
I think it was in the areas of before the majority. And I know I'm a little bit favored for this, but this is going to be the first time in history that we have the most young people in our House and in their Senate and even in leadership. And so I think people are looking for inclusive policy. I think they're looking for exactly what we're prioritizing in the LEO budget. It's for places to go, things to see, but also walkable communities, investment in our transportation, investment in our what those beautiful projects we're going toward is affordable housing, a place where they can afford to live here, work in the community or in the neighboring community so they can live and not spend their whole time in a car, but making sure that there's available stuff as far as like wellness centers or community centers, or there's even investments that we have created in our parks and our trail systems. I think these are strategic investments that is going to make Michigan a place to visit, but also a place to live in and grow a family. And I think we're headed in the right direction. And I also think that seeing more young people at the table is going to bring people in Michigan. As we saw on the policy side, a little bit more inclusivity when it comes to LGBT rights in the Elliott Larson. And as we moved swiftly, hearing straight from our universities and our young people about gun sense legislation, how fast we moved to make Michigan a place where people feel comfortable, people feel wanted, and they also feel like they're being respected. So I think that is a crucial piece. And as you might have to fact check on me on this, but as the youngest woman senator in Michigan's history, I do believe we have a voice like never before, and just about Michigan's future and how we get there. And I do think I am honored that to be with the majority leader, Senator Brinks, because she's really uplifted voice of younger members like myself as LEO chair. A position specifically situated to invest in areas that attract and retain young families. Senator Camilleri as chair of pre-K through 12 for world-class public education to the next generation. And as far as Senator Malin McMorrow, Senator Anthony, and I even want to give a little bit of an uplift to Senator Anthony and all the work that she did. She was appointed to be chair of Senate Appropriations, to really put the state funding in the hands of a young, experienced woman who can set our state up for success. No matter the color of your skin, the texture of your hair, or the background, you can really make it in Michigan here.
It's so crazy because I even think about, you know, talking about what makes a community a thriving community, and, you know, so many things are changing right now. So it's definitely been a unique opportunity to report on the legislature and everything that's going on. So thank you so much, Senator Kavanaugh. I really appreciate you wanting to join me on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast.
Absolutely. Anytime, Sam.
No, thank you so much. And that's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to all of our guests this week, Michigan political reporters Joey Capoletti with AP and Colin Jackson with the Michigan Public Radio Network, Donald Roach with the Smart Union in Michigan, and of course, State Senator Mary Kavanaugh from Redford Township. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio in Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am your host, Samantha Shriver. I'm a lucky girl. I do lucky things. Getting all my dreams. But what is worth it seems like I'm a lucky girl.